Blog Talk Radio.
Skyrocketing healthcare and insurance costs. Extremely modest gains against chronic disease. Thousands die yearly due to drug reactions. What can be done? Thomas Edison is quoted as declaring, "The doctor of the future will give no medicine, but interest his patients in diet and nutrition, exercise, and the care of the human frame. He will teach them about the cause of all disease." The doctors of the future are here. Welcome to Phase 3 Wellness with your host, Keith Henry, MD, one of the doctors of the future. Skyrocketing healthcare and insurance costs. Extremely modest gains.
Okay, we seem to have lost connection for a minute. I don't know. My system just told me that I was cut off and I had to reconnect. Hopefully, we are still on track. Hopefully, you can hear me okay. We have, again, some technical difficulties today. This is Dr. Keith Henry. You listen to the Phase 3 Wellness Show and podcast here. We've been talking about some of the connections between some prominent doctors and their and these medical journals. And again, I don't know where my system cut me off, but it just notified me that I was not connected. I'm reconnected now, but I'm going to just pick up. I don't know where. I have no one to shore it over. I have to go back and when we edit it, we'll see. But we were talking about some of the doctors and even some of the prominent medical journals where they're basically, whenever they're not disclosing these things, whenever doctors are writing in these medical journals and they're not disclosing that they have a relationship with companies that they're writing for and have a financial, and they stand to have some type of financial relationship or financial benefit, and they're writing these articles, it's not fair to the reader, and it's outright really fraudulent and deceptive. The article in New York Times, we're going to say, as the debate continues, an influential group, the International Committee of Medical Journal Editors, is considering a policy that would refer researchers who commit major disclosure errors to their institutions for possible charges of research misconduct. And I think that is definitely an excellent suggestion and recommendation. Because, you know, we need to consider this. You will have a little man on the street here who say he's, you know, doing something and something that's really not that significant. He say he stole something out of the store, or he's selling some type of a little bit of drugs on the street, say some marijuana or something. Not that I'm justifying those things, but I'm saying to make a point. With those guys are taken and thrown in jail and given a misdemeanor and sometimes a felony, whatever the case might be, and they're held accountable for having much less influence than some of these guys have and girls have, and their crime and their deception, consequences could be much more significant in the lives and possible deaths of other people who are relying on this information to make decisions. But many times they tend to get a pass when the little guy who has no influence or has no say so in what's going on for what's something that's comparatively small can be thrown in jail. I have a record when these people are making decisions that could affect hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. And they go on to not be held accountable. The article here in the New York Times goes on to say, medical journals and professional societies strengthen their requirements. Let me back up here. The article goes on to say, Concerns about the influence of drug companies on medical research have persisted for decades. And the article says Senator Estes Kefauver, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, held hearings on the issue in 1959, and there was another surge of concern about these concerns with the drug companies' influence over medical research. There was a surge of concern to say that in 2000, after a series of scandals in which prominent doctors failed to reveal their industry relationships. And it points out further how medical journals and professional societies strengthen their requirements, but the drug industry restricted how it compensates doctors, prohibiting gifts like tickets to sporting events or luxury trips, although evidence, it says, of kickbacks and corruption continues to surface in criminal prosecution. So on the surface, they say, oh, we're not doing these things, but behind the scenes, they're still doing them, which again, like I said earlier, is human nature. This is why when you have this relationship, it's going to happen. The article goes on to point out how there was a 2010 federal law required pharmaceutical and device makers to publicly report their payments to physicians. Despite these changes, it says the system for disclosing conflicts remains fragmented and very weakly enforced because there's too many people that stand to make too much money. And many of the very people who are supposed to be enforcing the laws are ones behind the scenes that can benefit from the laws. The article is going to say that medical journals and professional societies have a variety of guidelines about what types of relationships must be reported, often leaving it up to the researcher to decide what is relevant. There are a few repercussions, it says, beyond a correction for those who fail to follow the rules. It says further, the article went on to point out that, and it gives an example of the American Cancer Association for Cancer Research and how it has warned its authors that they face a 3-year ban if they are found to have omitted a potential conflict. But the article says, but the group's policy on conflicts of interest contains no mention of such a penalty. And it is said no author has ever been barred. And the article is going to say further that Dr. Basilagov's failure to disclose his industry relationship extended to the association's journal, Cancer Discovery, for which he served as one of two editors-in-chief. The association said it in investigating Dr. Basilagov's actions, which is kind of the article is just a bit unclear there. But basically says most authors do seem to disclose their ties to corporate interests. About 2/3 of the authors on the Kiss Quality study, for example, reported relationships with companies, including Novartis. But the researchers who did not included Dr. Ortega, Dr. Burris, and Dr. Denise A. Yardley, a senior investigator who worked with Dr. Burris at Sarah Cannon. The article went on to say further, the Tennessee-based Research Center received more than $105,000 in fees for consulting, speaking and other services on Dr. Yardley's behalf in the 3-year period in which she declared no conflicts. The Sarah Cannon Institute said it switched over a year ago to a quote, universal disclosure, end quote, practice promoted by ASCO, the cancer group that Dr. Burris will lead. That requires doctors to disclose all payments, including those made to their institution. So Dr. Burris, who was one of the chief offenders, is going to head up a group promoted by ASCO. He will head up ASCO, a group that will basically oversee the reporting of these relationships. But wait, how do you take a man who himself has been implicated in these non-disclosures and then say that the Sarah Cannon Institute switched over to a program a year ago, which will require, quote, universal disclosure, promoted by ASCO, the cancer group that Dr. Burris will lead. And then they say, we believe we adhere to the highest ethical standards in the industry by not allowing personal compensation to be paid to our leadership, physicians, the center said. ASCO said it would post corrections to Dr. Burris' disclosures in the Journal of Clinical Oncology for the past 4 years. The group said that in the fall of 2017, if Dr. Burris was seeking a leadership role in the organization, it began working with him to disclose all his company relationships, including indirect payments. Dr. Burris would become president in June 2019. Disclosure system, it says, quote, disclosure systems and processes in medicine cannot perfect yet, or not perfect yet, and neither are ASCO's, the group said in an email. And it goes on to say that Dr. Burris Dr. Yardley and Dr. Ortega submitted updated disclosures to the New England Journal of Medicine, which posted them on this past Thursday. But there are no penalties, there's no punishment. They just get to say, oh yeah, we purposely didn't report these things, but oh well, they're going to ride off into the sunset. Well, I'm out of time on that particular article. You can go and look it up. It's on. There's a little bit more to it, but basically it was published on December the 9th in New York Times, December the 8th, I'm sorry, in the New York Times, and the authors are Chris Charles Ornstein and Katie Thomas. You listen to Phase 3 Wellness. We did have some type of technical difficulties. I don't know how much you missed in that that first part that I was discussing there. But we're going to go ahead now to us, because I'm down to really low on my time, and I don't really know what happened with our technical side there. Anyway, we're going to talk about kiwi. I was going to go into more detail about the kiwi and its benefits, but I'm down to about 12 minutes. So I'm just going to talk about a study that came out with kiwi and how it basically has been shown to be beneficial in helping the constipation. Now, this is a study published in the Asia Pacific Journal of Clinical Nutrition. Again, as far as we know, the authors of this study did not have any undisclosed connections. It says this study is published in the Asia Pacific Journal of Clinical Nutrition, and it revealed that kiwi has potential use as a natural remedy for not only constipation, but also for irritable bowel syndrome. So now let me back up here and look a little bit more at kiwi and its benefit in terms of constipation. Now, as most of you know, constipation is characterized by basically less than 3 bowel movements per week. I would say you're constipated from a naturopathic perspective if you don't have a bowel movement within roughly 45 minutes to an hour or so after each major meal that you eat. And so as opposed to having less than 3 bowel movements per week. Now think about that, having less than 3 bowel movements per week. So let's break it down for a minute. If you eat 3 meals a day, some people eat several small meals a day, which I think is ludicrous, they're getting that from many of the nutritionists, but that's neither here nor there for the moment. But consider, they're saying that less than 3 bowel movements a week, you're considered constipated. But just consider someone who may eat 3 meals a day. And a week, that's 21 meals. And if you're only having 3 bowel movements, where are the other 19 meals? 18 or 19 meals. And they don't think that you're constipated if you're not going to. Anyway, let's go ahead. The problem with constipation is it's a gastrointestinal problem, and it's commonly caused by physical inactivity and poor diet, as well as not drinking enough water, and sometimes even in aging. But most of the time, constipation can resolve itself if you make lifestyle changes. But if it persists, sometimes they will want to put you on medication, and some professionals say you need to take laxatives. But many of these laxatives have side effects like diarrhea, cramps, electrolyte imbalance, dehydration, etc. But when you look at kiwi, which is just a familiar fruit to most people, studies have shown that eating kiwi significantly improves or can significantly improve the softness and the bulk of your stools, making it easy for them to pass out through the intestines and be removed from your body. And think about it, even if you're not suffering from kiwi, from constipation, it's a good idea to eat kiwi as well as other fruits and vegetables. Because of their fiber content, they tend to help the bowels move better. So again, remember, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, most definitely. Now, if you look at kiwi from a therapeutic perspective, the therapeutic potential of kiwi can be attributed to its phytochemicals, actinidin and pectin. And Actinidin is an enzyme that improves the flow of things through the digestive tract, while pectin is a fiber that can actually buck up the stool and help it pass through the system easier. So if you think about it, in addition, these two compounds, actinidin and pectin, actually also can, they function in your body. They can serve almost like prebiotics, and which are foods that are beneficial to your gut bacteria. And also they can help prevent the growth of pathogenic bacteria or the negative or bad bacteria in the gut. Now, kiwi pectin specifically has been found to inhibit the growth of salmonella. And it does this by reducing the ability to stick to the gut, by reducing salmonella's ability to stick to the gut and promote lactobacillus growth by increasing its stickiness. So these properties don't just benefit gastrointestinal health, but immune function. That's because remember, about 70-80% of the immune system is found in your gut. Very significant. So kiwi, because of the way the Creator has made it, is basically beneficial to help with constipation. It's beneficial with helping with your immune system because it benefits the gut, and 70-80% of your immune system is in the gut. Now, like I said earlier, the study published in the Asia Pacific Journal of Clinical Nutrition also revealed that kiwi has potential use as a natural remedy for irritable bowel syndrome. And basically, the study pointed out how patients who have this condition suffer from both constipation and diarrhea. So some remedies for the former might encourage the latter and vice versa. But when you look at kiwi, they observed when consumption of kiwi, they found that it improved overall bowel function without the risk of aggravating either symptom of diarrhea or constipation. It also prevented the production of chemicals that promote inflammation. So it also, as a result, helped inflammatory bowel disease. There has been other previous studies that show that kiwi has the potential use against various gastrointestinal disorders, and so it has therapeutic. Even though it's a tasty food, it also has therapeutic benefit of the therapeutic medicine. So remember, it's almost like Hippocrates said, "Let your food be your medicine, and your medicine be your food." And there's some other benefits that have been associated with kiwi as well. Benefits like kiwi being able to help regulate blood pressure, being able to help protect the DNA from damage, being able to help promote weight loss, help to prevent macular degeneration, helps improve the skin, and also associated with having a benefit to also help maintain a normal blood sugar level. Again, that is kiwi. You listen to Phase 3 Wellness. I'm your host, Dr. Keith Henry. I want to thank you for joining me so far. We're going to pivot to our last segment because we are actually almost out of time. And I'm really hoping that we didn't miss too much of that first segment because it's a crucially important segment. I'm going to, in our last 5 minutes here, I'm going to try to look at hawthorn berry as we pivot over to our last segment, the healing herb segment. Now, I've talked about hawthorn berry before on here in the past. I just want to talk about it again here because sometimes new information comes out or I want to address it from a different angle that I might have not addressed it from before. And so with regard to hawthorn berry, it's been very beneficial for, you heard me say this before, for your heart and for your circulatory system as a whole. It is, if you use regularly, it can protect your heart against the beginning stages of heart disease. It's also excellent to help speed recovery if you've had a heart attack. Now, every herb has a nutritional profile. Every food has a nutritional profile. And some of the nutritional profile of hawthorn berry is that it includes vitamin A, it includes vitamin C, it has sodium, selenium, it has potassium, it has chromium, it has niacin. Not only that, it has probably about 19 other nutrients, roughly, in it. Now, it's interesting that the University of Michigan pointed out with respect to hawthorn, and I'm going to give a quote here. They say that hawthorn is an antioxidant. It says, quote, antioxidant hawthorn appears to reduce symptoms and improve exercise capacity by increasing blood flow to the heart and the strength of heart contractions and reducing resistance to blood flow in the extremities. Clinical trials have shown that standardized extracts made from the leaves and flowers of hawthorn are effective in helping people with early stage CHF, means congestive heart failure, CHF. The University of Michigan goes on to say, hawthorn extracts appear to increase blood flow to the heart, increase the strength of heart contractions, reduce resistance to blood flow in the extremities, and act as an antioxidant. They go on to say, in a large preliminary trial, people with mild to moderate congestive heart failure were given 300 milligrams of hawthorn flower and leaf extract, standardized to contain 2.2% flavonoids, three times a day. So that would be 900 milligrams for 2 months. Symptoms of congestive heart failure, including heart palpitations, chest pressure, and swelling in the extremities, decreased throughout the trial during the use of hawthorn. The efficacy of hawthorn for the treatment of congestive heart failure has been confirmed in a double-blind trial, and they recommended that if you're not using the standardized amount, which is basically when they say standardized, it basically means in general, they've taken a particular herb, in this case hawthorn, and they've zeroed in on what they think to be the major element in that herb, constituent in that herb, that's giving you the benefit, and they standardize it to a particular amount. Because if you're just getting herbs, say you take hawthorn, or get a batch of hawthorn, it may have less or more of a particular amount of the active ingredient in each batch. So it'll be a variance. So in order to standardize it, what they do is they say we want X amount in each batch, in each capsule that you take. Where if you take the free herb, loose herb, they recommend that you take 4,000 to 6,000. The equivalent of 4,000 to 6,000grams of the whole herb. And so again, I like the whole herb better. Now, some research shows that hawthorn is one of the herbs that works better in the standardized form, but the majority of the time, when you're working with the loose or the whole herb, there are other constituents in there that enhance what may be the main constituent that you're getting benefits from. So by separating it from the other constituents in the herbs and standardizing it, you could be losing some of the benefits of some of the other constituents that are contained in it that work synergistically with the herb to help, not with the herb per se, but with the main ingredient that you think is causing the herb to work more efficaciously. So again, there are sometimes places for the standardized extract or the standardized herbs, and but I just in general have seen when you use the whole herb, you're going to get in general a better outcome. Notwithstanding, there are times when the standardized herb you may get a better outcome, or maybe the particular case may be better for a short time to use that standardized herb. Hawthorn berry is an excellent, excellent, excellent herb. I consider that if you have any heart issues to help prevent it, or if you have had heart issues, I highly recommend use it to help rebuild the heart. It's a good idea to use it in combination with cayenne pepper to help it get you the cells in a more efficacious manner. I want to thank you for listening today. Sorry for the technical difficulties. We're going to have to go in and find out where the problem occurred. And until next week, have a blessed one, and I will see you again on Phase 3 Wellness. Be blessed.